Coming up next on Louisiana Eats, we examine the evolution of dining in the U.S. and the restaurants that transformed modern American cuisine. We begin with Yale historian Paul Friedman, author of 10 Restaurants That Changed America.
My criteria is really influence, not necessarily restaurants that were wonderful or whose food conforms to our current standards of what we admire.
Then we talk with one of those restaurants' famed co-owners, Julian Nicolini of New York's Four Seasons.
We were greeting them every day. We were giving hard time to our guests every day, and they just loved it.
A hard time to the guests?
Well, of course.
Like, how do you mean?
Well, you have to punish them.
We're looking at influential restaurants and a cast of unconventional restaurateurs on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next, but first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The White House continues to defend Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, who's facing multiple allegations of sexual misconduct. Press Secretary Sarah Sanders is accusing Democrats of derailing the confirmation process from the start.
On the night President Trump nominated Judge Brett Kavanaugh, Senator Schumer declared the Democrats would oppose this nomination with everything they had. Before a single document was produced, a single meeting with the senator, or a hearing was ever scheduled, Chuck Schumer and the Senate Democrats telegraphed a strategy to throw the kitchen sink at the judge with no regard for the process, decency, or standards.
The FBI is in the midst of conducting a supplemental background investigation into the claims made against Kavanaugh. The agency is expected to release its findings by the end of the week. Senate Republicans are pushing for a full vote on his confirmation by then. President Trump is taking to social media to push back against a scathing report published in the New York Times. NPR's Scott Horsley says the article reports that Trump and his family used dubious schemes to evade taxes on hundreds of millions of dollars in inherited wealth.
The New York Times 14,000-word story was the product of more than a year of investigation. It shows that despite his claims to be a self-made billionaire, President Trump was the beneficiary of a vast inherited fortune, much of which was shielded from taxes through a variety of questionable schemes. New York taxing authorities say they're reviewing the article's findings. In his tweet, the president does not dispute any of the facts in the article, but describes it as, quote, a very old, boring, and often told hit piece. Trump complains the vast majority of the newspaper's coverage of his administration has been negative, echoing a charge leveled by the White House press secretary. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The death toll from last week's magnitude 7.5 earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia now surpasses 1,400. NPR's Julie McCarthy is in the city of Palu near the epicenter.
As you enter the city of Palu, there is all kinds of signs of distress and frustration, but not violence or unrest. You feel that there is a sense of desperation. People are holding signs up saying, we need help too. We need food. And you have little children chasing the cars, and people are throwing out their food at them.
NPR's Julie McCarthy reporting from the island of Sulawesi, Indonesia. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is set to conduct the first test of a new national wireless emergency alert system later this hour. Most cell phones across the U.S. will ring or vibrate at 2 ATP Eastern Time. The alert will ensure the system would work in the event of a national crisis. This is NPR News. The woman whose name became immortal in two Buddy Holly songs has died. Petty Sue Guerin died Monday in Lubbock, Texas. She was 78 years old. NPR's Anastasios Lucas reports that her love affair became crystallized in pop history.
When Buddy Holly and the Crickets started performing the song, Peggy Sue Guerin was a 17-year-old who dated the band's drummer, Jerry Allison.
If you knew Peggy Sue, then you know why I feel blue.
Buddy Holly was writing a song to Cindy Lou, but Allison had another idea, as he told NPR in 2000.
I had a girlfriend at the time named Peggy Sue, so I talked to him and he changed it to Peggy Sue, and then we finished it.
The couple got married after she graduated from high school, and Buddy Holly wrote Peggy Sue Got Married. But the two divorced 9 years later. And Guerin claimed in her autobiography that she'd actually been in love with Buddy Holly. Anastasia Tsoulkas, NPR News, New York.
First Lady Melania Trump is continuing her multi-nation African tour. She visited a former slave-holding facility on the coast of Ghana today.
The dungeons that I saw, it's really something that people should see and experience, and what happened so many years ago, it's really a tragedy.
Mrs. Trump will also visit Kenya, Malawi, and Egypt with a focus on promoting health and education. She's also set to promote her Be Best initiative, which aims to tackle issues such as cyberbullying and boost healthy living. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from LogMeIn, maker of GoToMeeting, proud sponsor of the How I Built This Summit, taking place in San Francisco at the Yerba Buena Center October 16th. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Zatarain's, maker of New Orleans pantry staples like Creole mustard, fish fry, and jambalaya mix since 1889. Recipes and more at Zatarain's.com. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. One of the most famed restaurants in the world was New York's Four Seasons, which for decades was arguably the number one most expensive and exclusive eatery in all of the Big Apple. Restaurateur Julian Nicolini played a huge role in making that a reality. The original Four Seasons, located in the iconic Seagram's building in Midtown Manhattan, closed its doors in 2016, with a promise of reopening one day soon on Park Avenue. New Orleans restaurateur Ralph Brennan invited Julian and his staff to come to New Orleans and recreate the magic that was the Four Seasons right here on Royal Street at Brennan's. Needless to say, that was the pop-up to end all pop-ups. We sat down with Julian during his time here to learn more about the original Four Seasons. Yale professor and author Paul Friedman identified the Four Seasons as one of the 10 restaurants that changed America. We'll hear Paul's thoughts on the subject, and then we'll examine the role that menus have historically played in restaurants across America. So pop the cork on the bubbly and get ready for a luxurious ride on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Paul Friedman. I'm the author of a book called 10 Restaurants That Changed America.
As a young graduate student at UC Berkeley, Paul Friedman's thesis focused on medieval history. This led him to study the culinary tastes of medieval people and to author a book on that subject. Mr. Friedman's latest book, 10 Restaurants That Changed America, focuses on more current American culinary history and restaurants that were crucial to forging that history. Paul, welcome to Louisiana Eats, and such an honor to have you here in the studio with us.
Well, it's an honor and a pleasure for me to be here.
I am so curious about so many things that have to do with this book, and I understand that in order to write the book, you literally poured through hundreds of thousands of restaurants over two centuries. What's your criteria?
My criteria is really influence, restaurants that were influential, not necessarily restaurants that were wonderful or whose food conforms to our current standards of what we admire.
So walk us through the 10 and why they were selected for this honor.
Well, chronologically, the first is Delmonico's. And this is Delmonico's in New York, and it was established in about 1830. It's really the first restaurant in the United States, by restaurant meaning a place that gives you a choice of what to order from a menu, a choice of who you want to eat with. It also dominated fine dining and the image of fine dining throughout the 19th century. The second is Antoine's in New Orleans, chosen as a representative of the most vibrant and long-lasting regional cuisine of the United States, and also one of the oldest restaurants in the United States.
Second oldest.
Second oldest, exactly.
Continuously operating.
And the oldest continuously operated by the same family. So then Schraft's, which was a chain of restaurants in the Northeast that really got going around 1900, and it is a pioneer of middle-class dining, so not elegant like Antoine's and Delmonico's, but not just a kind of hash house or luncheonette. The other reason it's important is that it was the first, among the first restaurants to appeal to women, not just by atmosphere, but by the kind of food that women were thought to like. Light food, but also fancy desserts, ice cream in particular.
So if you were to dine at Schraft's, what might a typical meal there be like?
Well, I can tell you based on my grandmother, who loved Schraft's. My grandmother would have had cottage cheese and fruit or chicken salad or club sandwich, something pretty light, and then follow it up with a banana split or a sundae.
Well,
and that's what it was
like
designed
fun.
For. So my next restaurant is Howard Johnson's. Howard Johnson's is the pioneer in the fast food industry because it invents franchising, and it also is the first restaurant as a chain to establish itself on the road and to appeal to the traveler in families.
On the road around the corner, here's the place to go. The orange roof of Howard Johnson's. Join the folks who know.
So it was the first kind of family-friendly restaurant, and it was the largest restaurant chain in the U.S. In the 1960s, it served more meals than any other institution except for the U.S. Army.
How many Howard Johnson's were there in its heyday?
About 1,000, coast to coast. Yes, and there's only one left. It's in Lake George, New York. It survives as the last of the franchisees. So Howard Johnson had franchises and it had restaurants owned by the company. When the company was broken up and sold, the franchisees were orphaned and they folded slowly and gradually as they either turned into some other restaurant or just closed, retired, couldn't make any money. So this is the last one.
Who was Howard Johnson?
He's like a number of founders of companies, a fanatic, a workaholic, very innovative, always tinkering with the look of the place, the marketing, the advertising, the architecture, the image. So he's really one of these founding geniuses of American business, the Henry Ford of the restaurant world. So my next pair of restaurants are what used to be called ethnic restaurants, a Chinese restaurant called the Mandarin in San Francisco. And the justification for that is you can't write about American restaurants without including Chinese restaurants. There are 40,000 of them today, more than McDonald's, KFC, and Burger King's combined. And then Mama Leone's, an Italian restaurant in New York, now closed. Mama Leone's was both a bohemian little kind of Chianti bottle with a candle in it place when it was founded in 1906, well into the 1920s, and then it became the largest restaurant in the United States in terms of size. It could serve easily 3,000, 3,500 people a night.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, it was huge. And it had huge quantities of food. That was its signature and a kind of stereotypical Italian joyous atmosphere. All the ladies were assured that the desserts had no calories. The waiters were flirtatious. The atmosphere was sort of operatic or artificially operatic, but it was an extremely successful restaurant and represented what people thought Italian food was for decades.
And who was Mama Leone?
Luisa Leone was the wife of a wine importer in New York, and she was a very good cook and cooked for friends. And Enrico Caruso was among the people who not so much convinced her to open a restaurant, because she was all for it, but convinced her husband in 1906 that this was a good idea. And they turned their front room of their brownstone or townhouse or glorified tenement building in the midtown neighborhood of the Metropolitan Opera, which was on 39th Street, into a restaurant, and it was tremendously successful. She was always very good at quantities. Her husband had the habit of inviting dozens of people to dinner without giving her much more than 2 hours warning. And she never complained about this. Not only knew how to do it, but considered that the normal way of doing business.
Tell me about the Mandarin in San Francisco. You know, San Francisco's got Chinatown. I guess Chinatown was pretty much always there. The Mandarin came along in 1961, so this wasn't revolutionary new Chinese food.
Well, it was a little bit on the revolutionary side because it served northern Chinese food and not Cantonese. It was high-end and not inexpensive. It was the first place that I ever had things like pot stickers, hot and sour soup, Peking duck, these northern specialties that now have become so standard. It was unusual in that it was the creation of a woman in what was a man's business, a woman who was not from southern China, was not Cantonese. And it wasn't in Chinatown. It first was on Polk Street, west of Chinatown in San Francisco, and then it moved to Ghirardelli Square, one of the first historical restorations of an old candy factory, and very beautiful and very high-end. And it had prestigious customers or famous customers like John Lennon ate there regularly, the Jefferson Airplane, famous rock group of the 60s, ate there. Its proprietor, its founder, Cecilia Chang, is perhaps the most striking, unusual, and entertaining person I've met in doing this research. She's now 97, very much active in the restaurant world, very much someone who seems to dine out all the time, can easily drink me under the table, has had a fascinating life and created the Mandarin almost really by accident in 1961. She was investing in what she thought was someone else's business, and the other people pulled out of it, leaving her holding a $10,000 debt. And so she figured she'd better try to open the restaurant herself. She was not an expert cook. She had grown up in a very wealthy family with two chefs and wasn't allowed in the kitchen because it wasn't appropriate for a woman of her class to learn such things. So she, too, is a genius, different kind of genius from Howard Deering Johnson, and one who is still influential in the American food scene and a legend.
When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Paul Friedman about the 10 restaurants that changed America. Stay tuned.
Hi, folks, this is Bill from the Dirty Rice Show, and I'd like to let y'all know that Dirty Rice has reverted back to its original two-hour format. That's right, we're going to be on the air from 9 until 11 p.m. every Saturday night right here on KRVS. So won't you join either myself or my co-host, Mr. Lee Klein, Peter, for 2 hours of Dirty Rice, 9 to 11, KRVS, 88.7 FM, KRVS.org.
This week in This American Life, Blake's friend Camille sent him an old photograph of herself. In it, she's a little kid on vacation with her family in Canada.
And then I glanced back at the picture, and I saw my grandma walking through behind her.
Blake and Camille grew up in different states. Camille didn't know him at that age or his grandma. Coincidences, do they mean anything this week?
Tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Dan Phillips, inviting you to Funkify Your Life, Thursday afternoons at 1 and Friday nights at 9, right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic French Quarter. Dishing up 200 years of history, refreshing Pimm's Cup cocktails, and toasty warm muffaladas. All-day dining and private events at 500 Charter Street. And now, our conversation with Paul Friedman, author of The 10 Restaurants That Changed America, continues.
Sylvia's in New York, founded in 1962, a very prosperous restaurant to this day, represents Southern food, the migration of Southern food to the North with the great migration of African Americans beginning around the First World War, and the different ways in which Southern food, soul food, what's sometimes called country cooking or down-home cooking, the interaction of these concepts.
Who were the people who owned Sylvia's?
They're a family from South Carolina. Sylvia Woods herself, her grandfather had been lynched, essentially, for a murder he didn't commit. Her grandmother didn't know how to read or write. They owned a farm. Her memories of Hemingway, South Carolina, are of a kind of idyllic life, despite this harsh treatment and subordination. There was a restaurant in Hemingway, but black people weren't allowed in it. So she had basically almost never been in a restaurant when she opened Sylvia's. She worked for a man who owned a luncheonette, and he sold it to her, and that's what became Sylvia's in
1962. Sylvia's opened. Was it segregated?
No, but Harlem had been the nightclub district of New York, particularly during Prohibition and a little bit in the 1930s. In 1962, it was still a neighborhood that had whites and blacks dining and to some extent going to entertainments together. But beginning in the mid-60s, it was segregated more by whites who were both afraid of what they regarded as a dangerous part of town and who tended to marginalize that part of town. African Americans themselves traveled all over New York to go to school, to have jobs. So it was really more a question of white people in New York perceiving the neighborhood as really having no attractions. When politicians would campaign at Sylvia's, white politicians like Ed Koch, the mayor for many years, thought it was actually the only restaurant in Harlem. When it was reviewed by Gail Green in New York Magazine in the 1970s, she said in retrospect her editor was doubtful about her going there because it would encourage readers to do something dangerous, namely go to Harlem, presumably white readers, naturally. And that really astounds me. It's as if you were encouraging people to drive 100 miles an hour or do something reckless. And, you know, would they get into trouble if suddenly people following Gail Green's review showed up in Harlem and got into trouble somehow? And she herself was amazed at the welcome she received, the fact that there was really, although the only problem she really had was getting a taxi to take her up to Harlem. In those days, taxi drivers flat out refused to. So it's really a demonstration of something that is a persistent aspect of segregation in the North where it wasn't legislated, but it was, as in many respects it remains, a fact of life.
And they're still open today.
They are prospering today. They're doing very well. Yeah, and they have very good food. They're right next to Red Rooster, the Marcus Samuelson restaurant, which has a more kind of perhaps hip take on African-American food. And the two restaurants seem to reinforce each other rather than competing.
Is their menu still the same?
They've taken some things off from their old menu. So some things that giblets, chicken gizzards. So they're more chicken and ribs and vegetables, collard greens, that kind of thing.
So for our next two restaurants, I suppose it would be wise to talk about Le Pavillon and the Four Seasons sort of in the same vein.
Definitely, because Le Pavillon, which opened in 1941 and closed in the mid-1970s, was the epitome of high-end French dining, which dominated American food at the high end until the 1970s and 80s. Le Pavillon was the creation of Henri Soulé. It was called Pavillon because it began as the restaurant at the French Pavilion of the World's Fair of 1939-40. And the Nazi invasion of France, the Blitzkrieg that destroyed the French government in the spring of 1940, stranded these restaurant workers, and Henri Soulé rallied them and created a restaurant in Manhattan that from the start, even in that inauspicious year 1941, was the place to dine, the place not only to be seen, but that everybody agreed had the best food. But best food at that time meant French food. Four Seasons, founded in 1959, was as elegant as Le Pavillon, although not in a kind of French Belle Époque manner, but in a magnificent modernist Bauhaus idiom, and it was deliberately not French. So that was the first high-end not French restaurant. It's hard to say exactly what it was. It certainly pioneered seasonality in certain respects as we know it. They had greens that they gathered, that they foraged. They had mushrooms. They had an herb garden. At the same time, they defined seasonal not as local. So if truffles were in season in France, they imported truffles. They had a lot of imported items, salmon from Norway, for example, Dover sole, always a signature item. So they weren't exactly an anticipation of what we now know as local and seasonal. They weren't even exactly American, but they were the first restaurant really to emphasize something that was not French at the high end.
Yet not American at the Four Seasons in many ways. From there, you go to the last one on your list, and I don't think you get any more American in a new American way than Chez Panisse.
That's right. Chez Panisse, on the other hand, as its name tells you, began as a French restaurant. So that in 1971, when it was founded, Four Seasons would seem to be much more innovative than Chez Panisse. Chez Panisse began with Alice Waters' dream of recreating a rural French auberge that served just a few dishes. But her governing concept of quality of the basic ingredients as opposed to exoticness of the basic ingredients, her focus on local and on seasonal, and some influences such as particular chefs, the influence of Provence and Italy, steered her towards a kind of cuisine that, for want of a better term, could be called New American. I know that she herself has told me she doesn't like the term California cuisine. Mm-hmm. So it is a rediscovery of something that Americans, we haven't really liked or thought about that much. We've tended to like variety or new things or imported stuff and not focused on how good is this peach? How good is this tomato? How interesting is this cheese? It's more, how far away did this come from? Or how many varieties of yogurt can I get, even though they're all made in a factory? The fact that this has changed is due to Chez Panisse. And I would say of all the restaurants in my list of 10, this is the one that people in the food writing and food industry world always accept without question. Nobody has said, oh, what's Chez Panisse doing in there?
Well, if you could dine anywhere in history today, where would you choose to dine? What is sort of your great holy grail of restaurants after having done all this research?
Well, I think I'd try Delmonico's in the 19th century. So it'd be some 19th century restaurant, because what I'd like to have would be that terrapin. I'd like to have wild canvas-back ducks with celery sauce, which is the other great specialty of the 19th century.
Well, I am so glad that I had this incredible opportunity to sit down and talk with you about your amazing new book. It's really a book that whether you're a chef or an eater, you'll want to devour from cover to cover. So thank you for making this time for us, Paul.
Well, thank you, Poppy. It's been an adventure for me and always a pleasure to be in New Orleans.
Paul Friedman, author of 10 Restaurants That Changed America. Longtime graphic designer, pop culture anthropologist, and executive editor for publishing house Taschen America, Jim Heineman provided the editing hand on the Taschen book, Menu Design in America. We spoke with Jim about his passion for menu preservation and how the publication came about.
You know, the menu book is the result of my own personal collection of menus. It's probably at this point somewhere around 30 years that I started collecting these. And that came from several books that I did prior to my work with Taschen. And I did a book on the history of the drive-in restaurants. And being a graphic designer, the graphics on these menus were pretty spectacular in some instances. So I started collecting these more for kind of research purposes, but then gradually the aesthetic of the menu cover really grabbed me. I just started going for it. And then it became kind of a critical mass. And this was one that he felt was definitely worthy of the large format that we put it into, because there's so much interesting stuff in these menus in relationship to the history of eating in America.
So tell us what you learned. Tell us about some of the trends that you saw come and go. What do we learn in this book?
Early on in the history of America, restaurants weren't really a pervasive element in dining at all. Most people ate at home, and hotels provided meals. And so that's probably the first instance where the public really is introduced to dining, is through hotels and traveling. Now, as America grew and restaurants became part of an urban environment, then you start seeing more and more restaurants. Now, in terms of food-wise, French cuisine seemed to dominate most of the menus. There are some regional aspects to a lot of restaurants that you might find fresh game in Colorado, or in San Francisco you might have seafood or Dungeness crab, things that are really local delicacies. So you would see these appear in these menus. So it really was telling in terms of, you know, what was available locally. But also the French cuisine was something that was so prevalent and was associated with fine dining that it really dominated. Then you roll into the advent of the car. So all of a sudden you're dining in your car with drive-ins and inexpensive food. The precursor to fast food makes its appearance, so hamburgers and hot dogs. We have rationing during World War II, which forces Americans to reconsider vegetables and other things that aren't meat-oriented. And then we get into the fast food era of the 50s, where things take on very kind of quick pace with coffee shops. The drive-in restaurant is still prevalent, but it starts its descendancy. And then you start having much more interesting cuisine in terms of the sophistication of the American palate.
Something else that seemed to be drastically clear to me is that when it comes to food, apparently sex really sells. And some of the nudity you see on these menus, and it's in every decade, I think would shock a lot of people today. Talk to us about some of those nudes on the menus.
Yeah, that was one aspect of the graphics that I found really interesting, because some of the subject matter that you find on some of these menus, there's some very, very provocative and salacious material on front, most of it having to do with women and nudity. So you have lots of bare-breasted women, lots of suggestive poses. Actually, one menu, which I thought was quite interesting, was for a men's club in San Francisco in the early part of the 20th century. And there's two satyrs that are dragging a nude woman, and she's tied up. And what that had to do with the meal, I'm not quite sure. I never expected to find that on a menu.
I think really, to people today, as shocking as the nudes might be, also some of the blatant racism issues. Talk to me about some of those just very politically incorrect things you find on those menus. And were they strictly from the South?
Oh, no. The subjugation of certain racial stereotypes fell in tandem with what was going on in most of cultural references at the time. The exaggeration of facial features was very prevalent. So blacks were depicted as a very cartoon-like manner. But it's not only limited to blacks. You know, Chinese were also the object of some of this racial stereotyping. There's a restaurant in Honolulu that the entire menu is done in pidgin English. The owner was Chinese, and so he used this kind of language that is so stereotypical of Chinese. He made it a point that he emphasized that as a selling point to come to the restaurant. So the entire menu, including the items, is all done in pidgin English through Chinese filter.
Then in that post-World War II period, there's a whole lot of the yellow peril sort of imagery, too. Huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's racial depictions of Chinese being yellow and mysterious. And again, this was what the cultural norms were at the time. And so people kind of went along with this depiction. And then it pretty much evaporates, although there are still some of those images appearing into the 60s and so on. But by the 70s, that's no longer acceptable. There wasn't necessarily just one particular segment of the population that was singled out for stereotyping. It went across the board.
Do you know how the menu itself began?
Yeah, it again follows the industrialization of the printing process, so that initially most restaurants didn't have a printed menu. The menu was really on a blackboard. Originally, someone would just come and tell you what items there were. And in most cases, there weren't a lot of items. So it was easy to memorize 6 or 7 entrees and so on. And then when it became a little bit more complex, then you would put them on a board. And then once the printing process became affordable in the late 1800s, then you started seeing people having printed menus. But again, most of it was in hotel restaurants, where you would find a printed menu, or for special occasions. So if there was a reunion of Civil War soldiers, you would find these menus printed, and they became very, very elaborate towards the end of the 19th century, with ribbons and die cuts and shapes. And for these special occasions, sometimes they would pull all the plugs out and do something really, really expensive. And they're really beautiful examples of the printer's art.
Jim, by your estimate, what's the state of the menu today? Is there anybody out there creating really remarkable menus?
Well, I'll tell you, I actually, as part of my graphic design career, I still design menus for restaurants here in L.A., so I'm just in the process of doing one right now. What has really taken over the menus is the computer. You know, people are talking about stuff on your iPhone, that when you go to a restaurant, you just go to a certain thing and you don't even have to talk to a waitress. You just decide what your items are and send it to the kitchen. So those things are slowly evolving in the restaurant world in terms of menu.
Well, I just was fascinated with the whole topic. Love, love, love the book. And I hope all the Louisiana Eats listeners have a chance to thumb through some Tashin books sometime in the future.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Jim Heineman, executive editor for Tashin America. What is Dover sole? And why has it always been such a status fish on restaurant menus? stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
I'm Cecil Doyle. Since the latter part of the 1980s, Earthbeat has been spotlighting sounds from around the world, from field recordings to classic vinyl to some of the latest smashes on the international scene. Join us for Earthbeat, Sundays 7 to 8 p.m., Thursdays 10 to 11 p.m., right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
This week on American Roots, El Sabor Latino in American music. From the West Coast, it's Mexican-American rockers Los Lobos. To the East Coast, salsa of Oscar Hernandez and the Spanish Harlem Orchestra. Plus a performance by San Antonio's queen of conjunto accordion, Eva Ibarra. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Coming up Friday afternoon at 1, right after the Blues Box, here on KRVS.
Hello, everyone. This is Sadie, letting y'all know that my new show, Off the Tracks, airs on Thursdays at 10 p.m. on 88.7 FM or online at krvs.org. And if you missed the show, just go to krvs.org to listen to it on demand.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Are you podcasting Louisiana Eats yet? If not, it's time to subscribe. Podcast listeners have access to full-length interviews with chefs like Edward Lee, Donald Link, and Michael Galata, along with new material that's never hit the airwaves before. Just visit poppytooker.com to subscribe. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is Dover sole, and why has it always been such a status fish on restaurant menus? Dover sole is a flatfish that lives in the northern Atlantic and Mediterranean Sea. The top side of a Dover sole is grayish-brown, and the underside is pearly white. In fact, it's a kissing cousin of the flounders that we regularly pull out of the Gulf. The name Dover comes from the English seaport of the same name that was the epicenter of sole fishing and distribution in the 19th century. Known for its mild, buttery, sweet flavor, it's also very easy to fillet. When the Four Seasons restaurant operated their all-too-brief pop-up at Brennan's, it was one of the offerings on the menu. Of course, I had to have it, and was thrilled to watch the waiter's tableside presentation as he expertly filleted and sauced my Dover sole. And it was delicious. But so is our flounder, and they don't have to travel from Europe to wind up on our Louisiana dinner tables, perhaps served with a little Meniere sauce, just like the classic Four Seasons Dover sole. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
My name is Giulia Nicolini, and I'm one of the partners of the Four Seasons restaurant in New York City.
One of Paul Friedman's 10 restaurants that changed America is going through some big changes of its own. The Four Seasons is about to be reincarnated in Manhattan, signaling a new chapter in its 60-year-old history. We were fortunate enough to sit down with Julian Nicolini during his visit to New Orleans when the Four Seasons restaurant briefly operated a pop-up at Brennan's on Royal Street. Julian began by explaining how his family's origins in New York first brought him to the hospitality industry.
Actually, the only family member in my family that was not born in this country was my mother. So I had three uncles here and one aunt here. So I had more relatives living in New York City than anywhere else at all. So, and that was extremely helpful. So basically, I stayed with them. My cousin was the general manager of the St. Regis Hotel for many, many years, so that was very helpful. When I was a kid, I was basically running around listening at the St. Regis roof.
Yeah.
We're listening to Frank Sinatra sing, Count Basie, Liza Minnelli, who else you want to say? And I was 18, 19 years old.
Oh.
So that's how it all happened. I mean, I've never been out of the restaurant business in my life. It's more than a profession. It's something that you really like.
So yeah. The Four Seasons, yeah, as we knew it, mm-hmm, is no more.
You know, restaurants are all about people. It's not the interior that sings, are the people themselves. So Four Seasons closed down on July 17, 2016. The new Four Seasons is going to open up at 280 Park Avenue, which is not too far away.
And as a matter of fact, the Four Seasons is having its own little moment in New Orleans, which is,
yes,
really an incredible, yeah, thing. Now, how in the world did you come to operate for a brief magic time in New Orleans, a pop-up?
Well, I don't think we're operating it at all. I think we're delighted to be with Ralph Brennan and his team. And I mean, it came about because, you know, this is one of the most iconic restaurant in the United States, and New Orleans for sure. So, and our brand also is an iconic name as well. And so, since we are in the process of reopening our own restaurant, and we are in the process of talking to a lot of farmer and fish people and winery people and so on, so I think it was very appropriate for us to come to New Orleans.
Take us back to its beginnings. Tell me about that experience, what it was like.
The original Four Seasons restaurant was developed by Restaurant Associates in 1958, and the doors opened up in July 20, 1959. And the restaurant was basically commissioned by the Seagram's family. You know, Seagram was a major liquor corporation at that time, no longer is. So they moved all their offices to the Seagram's building at 375 Park Avenue, and they wanted to have a restaurant downstairs. And that's basically how the Four Seasons was born. So the restaurant itself was designed by Philip Johnson. You know, they were two very austere rooms. One of them was called the pool room. One of them was called the grill room. And we had the bar. We also had a very large private dining room and another smaller private dining room and so on. And the gentleman or the genius behind all this operation was a gentleman by the name of Joe Baum. And Joe Baum at that time, from probably 1959 until about probably the middle 80s, was still considered one of the most incredible innovators of the restaurant business in America. So basically what you have here, you have a tremendous space. You have a man who happens to be a genius about basically inventing American cuisine. And that's basically how the Four Seasons was born. It was born a collaboration between Seagram, the Bromfam family, Restaurant Associate, and Joe Baum.
Well, that was a long time ago, 1959.
Yeah.
How was the restaurant received in the early days?
I know that the New York Times claimed that was one of the most expensive meals, it was the most expensive wine, incredible service, and so on. But it wasn't really as popular as it could have been, because during that particular time in New York City, the French restaurant were really the restaurant that really ruled New York City. So people didn't really care about going to the Four Seasons at all. People cared much more about going to Le Pavillon, La Côte Basque, La Grenouille, La Caravelle, all this fancy, you know, because it was a different era. Well, then came quite a little bit of a revolution, because even though the Four Seasons basically introduced farm-to-table food, the Four Seasons in 1959, they had their own farm, growing their own vegetable that nobody's ever heard of. They were growing their own herbs that nobody's ever heard of, you know. And, you know, for American, I think it was a totally new concept. And with the help of James Beard, of course, and a lot of other incredible chefs, you know, they really made it happen. So basically, whether, Japanese likes it or not, and I know that a lot of people may be wondering, you know, where the truth lies, but the Four Seasons was really the first American restaurant to really introduce American food to American people.
Well,
at that level, in 1959.
That date but trumps everything.
But the revolution really started in the 70s after these two people, Tom Margheta and Paul Covey, took over the restaurant, and they start convincing people, and the media got hold of this, and everybody start moving forward to this new American cuisine. And this is really where American cuisine started, where people like it or not. California cuisine, American, this is it.
Well, I think that the professor, Yale professor, yeah. Paul Friedman,
oh, yes.
sort of set
oh,
that
yes.
straight.
Oh,
and
good.
So I know that the Four Seasons yeah. is, in his very studied thoughts, one of the 10 restaurants that changed America.
No question about it. No question. I mean, think about how many people knew about James Beard in the 1980s. Nobody knew anything about James Beard. James Beard was a genius as well. I mean, he developed a lot of menu for the Four Seasons restaurant. He came to the Four Seasons restaurant before all these incredible chefs. Oh, James Beard, I'm getting a James Beard award. Yes. Did you know James Beard? No, of course not. But, I mean, nobody really seems to even understand what James Beard stood for.
You knew James Beard.
Well, of course we knew James Beard. I mean, the most incredible impression about James Beard that I have or always had was, you know, I started working at Four Seasons in 1977. And so this guy used to come to the Four Seasons, the first, especially for lunch. The first thing he used to do, he would go into the kitchen, talk to the chef, you know, give him a hug and so on, then go to the table, sit at the table, have a very leisurely lunch, Chivas, white wine, red wine, and then get up and walk out. You know, so I said, well, fine, you know, I guess, you know, it must be very important. 6 months later, I said to one of the owners of the Four Seasons, then I said, well, let me ask you a question. Who's paying the check? Oh, he says, if James Beard would ever pay a check, he would have a heart attack. It really didn't matter if James Beard went to the Four Seasons and went to the Gritti Palace in Venice or the most he never paid a check because everybody at that time, some of the people in the food business exactly knew who it was. You know, it was giving you very good advice. And in order to, instead of paying him back for the advice that he was giving you, you just gave him a free lunch or free dinner.
Well, it's like having a deity come and visit your restaurant. So, Julian, tell us about your personal journey. You become involved with the Four Seasons in 1977.
Yes.
So, you know, today, 1977, and we're in 2017. That's quite a long time.
It's really a long time. It's really amazing because, first of all, it was a little difficult at the very beginning to work at the Four Seasons. But I'll tell you how it happened. So I was working at the Palace Restaurant on 58th Street. And at that 1975, it was by Craig Claiborne, the best restaurant in America outside of France. It was a French restaurant. We had a 13-course dinner, and the price was only $55.
Oh, my.
Okay? So, and I decided, because I knew that a lot of our French people would never say any good things about the Four Seasons restaurant, I decided to go there. I took a friend of mine for dinner, and I was extremely impressed. The next day, I called up one of the owners, which I knew. I called him up, and I said, I would like to know whether there is a job available for me. And he made me wait, you know, for a couple of hours, and then I got the job. It became a real club. And it became a real club because, you know, we were there every day. We were greeting them every day. We were giving hard time to our guests every day, and they just loved it.
A hard time to the guests?
Oh, of course.
Like, how do you mean?
Well, you have to punish them.
Oh, tell me about the punishment.
Oh, punishment, my favorite job for these people. You know, these people, they were all, you know, the people that basically run this country, you know. People that run Goldman Sachs, people that run Blackstone Group, BlackRock, and all this incredible institution. And mayor, senator, Hollywood stars, and so on. You know, you have, in order to make anything successful, you have to create some conflicts. If there is no conflict, then it gets boring. So I would manage to see people that totally dislike each other next to each other. I mean, or very close to it. Just because, you see, when they go to their offices and so on, they're all surrounded by yes men.
Right.
Forget it. When they go to a restaurant, they should have a little of their own medicine, you know?
I hear yeah. You used to trick them sometimes. There was a balcony in the grill room
that was
sort of in the nosebleed section.
Oh, of course.
What were the tricks you used to play with people regarding that
seat? I used to take some of these people that were very, you know, very conscious about their status. You know, if you have a banquet to the Four Seasons, you know, that means you're either a billionaire or, you know, you're pretty popular. So, and a lot of time, you know, people say, oh, today I'm coming with somebody very important, you know. And they would say, oh, really? And so what is that? So, oh, I need a boot today, please. And we only had 5 boots. And I knew that some of these people, they would have a heart attack if I ever took them to the wrong table. So I would wait for them at the front desk. Oh, Mr. Maron. Oh, yes. Oh, Sir Julian, today is very important. I would just walk him up the steps. Oh, God. Oh, my God, you should see their faces. No, you're doing this to me again? I mean, some of them, I only play with them until they got there, but then I gave them the table anyway. It was fun.
Julian, thank you so much for your generous, generous amount of time and for telling us your amazing story. We're honored. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you, New Orleans.
Julian Nicolini of the Four Seasons Restaurant. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you visited poppytooker.com lately? That's where you can hear our new Quick Bites podcast and also pre-order my latest book, The Pascal's Minnelli Cookbook, debuting this fall. If you've missed an episode of Louisiana Eats, you can hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, Rouse's Markets, and from Don's Seafood, where the Landry family has been serving real Louisiana eats since 1934. Visit Don's Seafood in Lafayette, Gonzales, Denham Springs, Hammond, Covington, or Metairie. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from the Bourbon House. From oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood and American whiskey on Bourbon Street. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. We're on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.